Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Today's podcast is presented by Podgo. Podgo is the easiest way for you to monetize your podcast, providing podcasters with a flat rate for ad space so you always know how much you get when you include an ad from Podgo. I recently joined as a member and you can too. Apply today to become a member and immediately be connected with advertisers that fit your audience. That's podgo.co at podgo.co. And remember, to include the name The Scoreless Thriller Podcast in your application. Thank you.
Man there trying to stop Drogba getting himself into further trouble. It's a fucking disgrace.
Oh, it's not a bad ball for Pelé on the right side. It's Carlos Alberto. And what a great goal that was! Carlos Alberto!
Maradona just walked away from Huddle then. Maldano, smoked and...
Met het balbezit voor Frank de Boer. Frank de Boer speelt de bal heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan! Dennis Bergkamp!
Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp!
Oh! Frank de Boer speelt de bal naar Dennis Bergkamp! Die neemt de bal feilloos aan! En die schiet de bal erin!
Hello? And welcome back to the Scoreless Thriller Podcast. I'm joined as always by Leon. Leon, how are you doing?
Super excited to be here today.
And we've got a special guest joining us today. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Yuri. Yuri Levy.
Nice night. Thank you guys for having me. I'm excited to join.
So Yuri is a Israeli-based football journalist who is the founder and writer at babagol.net, a football media channel which covers Latin America, Asia, focused on the Middle East and Africa, and provides insights on culture and society and politics and all where football meets to combine. Is that a pretty good summary of what you do?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So I think a good place for us to start, and so I wanted to get you on this podcast to talk about a story which is sort of transcended, is sort of, and it spreads across to Western media, where we're not normally sort of see football stories and stories from the region in places like the New York Times or in the UK media or European media. But I would, before we sort of get into that story on Beta Jerusalem, I would like to you to tell our listeners a bit more about yourself and, you know, where babagol.net comes from and like what your footballing journalism story is, because I think I've heard you on another podcast talk about this, so I think it'd be a good insight for our listeners.
Yeah, and it seems like an incredibly interesting project, so yeah.
Yeah, sure, with pleasure. You know, in the past decade, I would say 7 years, 8 years, I'm writing about football for a living. started really off as a basically some kind of a life-saving try, surviving university, connecting football to the topics that I was studying in my first degree, in my BA, Middle Eastern history and Latin American history, with Arabic and Spanish and Portuguese. And I decided to connect it to these regions, which I had always like a simple, you know, small passion about the football scenarios, playing Championship Manager or simply just watching tournaments on Eurosport, if it's the Africa Cup of Nations or the Asian Cup and things like that, and how every time it's evolving with politics and geopolitical issues and society and nationalism and cultures, basically. So I decided to go in this wave and start to write about it pretty avidly at the beginning for myself, for my Facebook page, for my personal Facebook page. But then my girlfriend, like, told me, come on, man, you know, not all your friends care about the new Paraguayan defender that started to represent Palestinian national team. Come on, stop. <You know? laughs> So Babagol was a combination of everything. And I managed to connect it pretty well during my studies, that in a certain stage I haven't written even one phrase in my studies that is not related to football in some way. In a pretty early stage in my second year in university, everything became heavily connected with football. And then I started to sell also pieces. Started my blog, Babagol, which was a pretty simple blogger page with minimum UX, UI awareness or anything.
Yeah.
But people joined in, more writers who also had this small secret passion for different regions, which are not the top five leagues, that are not Premier League, Champions League football, you know, mainstream. And we grew. Today we are a group of, depends on the time of the year, but between 9 to 17 writers that contributes weekly, or sometimes do weekly, sometimes, you know, on periods every day even, depends if it's a big tournament or so. And really we are focused on the Middle East, because most of the writers are coming here. You know, my ecosystem in Israel is pretty big. I'm working, since I started Babagol, I'm working with all the big medias here, and as well in the Middle East, in Qatar, in the UAE, in Egypt, Palestine, of course. You know, it's basically the same place, but I'm working with medias from over there. And, you know, I want to say that I'm, you know, I really like what I do, and I'm grateful for finding my place in football. But basically, I built a junction. I built a really good junction that connects East and West through football in the Middle East. Because I'm coming from a mixed family where people speak in Arabic and Hebrew. So I had these two, I would say, point of views on everything that is taking place here. And it's not an easy place. It's not a simple place. You know, I grew up in Jerusalem where, you know, buses were bombing and there was the second intifada. And these are things that even if you are safe and, you know, my family is okay and everybody were fine, you know, it's not that issue. But if you growing up in such environment, it's opened your mind, you know, for things that you wouldn't expect maybe in different places. And it's something that I brought in also the vibe into Babagol and you know, the team. So I think that, you know, we are right now on a certain junction that really unveils many stories that doesn't get their, you know, I would say the stage that they deserve to get. So we give them this stage in Babagol, even whether it's players that nobody heard from. From South America, we have this scout, Juan Gafas, from Latin America, who's writing about players that nobody heard of. And, you know, we are following these players and seeing them progressing, having very interesting careers, or really football in Palestine, West Bank Premier League, Israeli Premier League, always with the footballing story, but also what we can learn from it, what we can take from it, culture-wise, politically-wise, and obviously a story of you know, of Betar Jerusalem, what is taking place recently is it's Armani time, basically. Yeah, this is what Baba Gol is here for, exactly this.
Yeah, that's really also the feeling and the charisma that you feel when you read these stories. Like, you tap into something maybe that has not been covered as much by international media, but that conveys a lot. It's not just football, but it's always also something else, often something political or cultural. And this intersectionality, I think it's incredibly interesting to watch out for when you read through these articles. And I think also a good bridging point to what we want to talk about today. I just have one quick question, because you talked about this, that a lot of the people that work for Baba Gol are interested in maybe the leagues that are not mainstream. And why do you think that is? Is there some specific notion of football that is still present in these leagues that is happening outside of big transfer and these huge markets? Or why do you think the interest is there?
It's a brilliant question. You know, I think it's a question I ask myself every morning. Why we do what we do? Or sometimes I'm tired and I don't have the energy to edit now this story about, you know, this guy from Ecuador. Who heard of him? I doubt that even his mother knows him. Yeah, okay. But remembering the bigger picture every morning with the coffee, I know that, you know, like everything in life, well, in the small places, in the places that is tough and raw, the real magic of football in this case, but of life basically, is taking place. People in the beginning of the way, stories that are untold and in a way enclave a lot of humanity, a lot of struggles. And, you know, we, as someone who lives, and basically I provide myself through stories, through telling stories, where there is a conflict, there is a story. There is a narrative that you can hold on to and learn. And as a writer, you know, you must love to learn new things and to get an introduction to words you haven't been aware of. So I think each one of my writers had this perversion to a certain part of the world, and I appreciate every one of these perversions because it's also me, you know, and it's everyone has this soft spot. And I think that in a way, football, Premier League, Champions League, all the big, the massive football, even Bayern Munich, okay, Manchester United, Real Madrid, once. And when you go back in the past, they were exactly this. And in the essence of the game, each one of these mega clubs was a small club, was something, you know, a personal story of a grandmother and her grandchild who want to play, and she made the laundry and one player came. And all this is what's sitting in the essence of football. So, yeah, now it's a branded mega, you know, it's a mega rich organization that basically think called financial, economical decisions all the time, 24/7. So I think these people, the people who do Baba Gol, people are attracted, I think, by the virginity of other places, which are less developed, less in this manner, but also has rich history and stories and something to say and a stage to stand up on. So as I said, we give these people, these stories, the stage.
Mm. Do you feel like this sort of passion and also kind of connection to the club that you might find in the Middle East is something that's kind of something that's quite unique, and in some places maybe we may feel that it's kind of been lost, and actually people might be looking for a better connection to that club and that kind of thing, which they won't find in the sort of super clubs these days?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't, you know, disregard the connection or the feelings any fan, you know, in Manchester or in London has for its club. You cannot disregard it. And, you know, each fan, I have respect for each club. each national team and each feeling that the game is creating in a heart of somebody. Yeah, of course. But I do think that if you want to feel football, and you know, our slogan is keeping football real. If you want real football, football that, yeah, maybe the player smokes a pack of cigarettes a day, but he struck 20 goals last season in the Colombian Primera División, yes. So it's real, because it can be me, it can be you, or Alex, you know. So for me, I do think that, yeah, real football is in the outskirts. I'm saying it without disregarding any feelings of fans to their big clubs. You know, if I was born in Manchester, I probably was a Manchester City or Manchester United fan, and I would be happy about it, you know. It was part of my identity. So I have the utmost respect for any football identity, of course. But yes, if you want to keep it real, go to Babagol.
Cool. So I think that's a good little segue to move on to our main topic that we wanted to discuss today. So for those people who are kind of completely unaware of this story, they may have been aware of a documentary a few years ago called Forever Pure, which follows a season with Beitar Jerusalem, which is very connected sort of to the very right wing in Israeli politics. And the club has never had an Arab player. And during the season, the Russian owner brings two Muslim Chechens into the team, and it results in a revolt from the fans, a boycott, and the clubhouse at the training ground gets burnt down, and all hell breaks loose. So before we sort of go into the story at the moment, what was when that documentary was released? As someone who covers football in Israel, what was the reaction to this story coming out? And also, what was the effect on something like Babagol, which I presume other people sort of came to look for more information on the story?
Yeah. You know, my relationship with this movie is funny. It managed to shift in many directions during my career, because when it just came out, I wasn't even aware that it came out. You know, because as someone who lives here, and, you know, I was working in the Israeli Sport Channel back then as a freelancer, 2013, just doing some archive job, and the story about the Chechen players blew up. So, you know, it was part of Israeli football. It was part of something that's going on. It's like, right now, something will happen, like a weird transfer saga will take place in Brøndby or Copenhagen, okay, for example. I don't know. So when the movie came out, I already had Babagol, and we had it was time that we were covering the Indian Super League pretty heavily, and we had many Indian followers. These guys are very passionate about football, and they have many opinions, and they like to say them all. And we got hundreds of messages. All Israelis are hating Arabs. All Jerusalem people are racist, they hate Arabs. And, you know, it was very tough situation for me, because in Babagol, I'm not highlighting the fact that most of the team are based in Israel, or actually are Israelis, or I am Israeli. But I was in a situation that I needed, in a way, to defend something which I do not have any identification with, which is Beitar Jerusalem or La Familia, the radical fan group which was in the center of this saga. And so it was very hard for me at the beginning, and I said, oh, man, this movie is ruining our names, you know, because now everybody thinks that everyone related to football in Israel is racist. But I think in the long term, when I also myself went back to write about this story, and I understand that it's very important, there is a gap of knowledge about Israeli football and the way that the political identities of football club in Israel, the way they developed, there is a gap of knowledge in the world about it. So also I want to discover more about the history of Beitar and the Jews that coming from Arab countries, like my family, for example, and discovered many things. I can tell you this, in the long run, I think the movie did good, because it brought a mirror for many people not just the radical racist fans of Beitar Jerusalem, also the, you know, the we like to call them here the silent majority, because Beitar has 500,000 fans. It's a huge club here.
Yeah.
Nobody knows, but like outside of Israel, but Beitar has also Arab fans. They do.
Yeah.
Because it's a massive club, and for years it was the club of the underdogs, of all the people that the establishment is basically stepping on, declining them, not giving them the right you know, the right place in the Israeli society, the political game. And so many people identified with the Beitar for many years, until, you know, things became very much radicalized, and it changed a lot. And La Familia, thanks to Arkady Gaidamak, who was the owner of Beitar, enjoyed a huge financial support like no other fan group in the history of Israeli football. He literally financed them for like 2 years, 3 years, gave them a basement in the stadium to keep their equipment, and it was something much more organized. Because he was thinking, yeah, I will give them money, and they will vote for me in the elections for the Jerusalem municipality. Arkady Gaidamak was like a Russian oligarch who bought Beitar a few years before the Chechen player saga, and it was like his last, you know, I would say, last effort to do something exceptional with the team. So I would say that, you know, Forever Pure had a positive and negative impact on me personally, but for me personally, and I think for the majority of Beitar Jerusalem, or Beitar Jerusalem as a whole, the positive impact in the long term, of course, because otherwise we wouldn't have this discussion. We didn't have this movement, you know, to, yes, Beitar must have a Muslim player, an Arab Muslim player. And, you know, without this discussion, they weren't playing now number 55 in their lineup every game, Ali Muhammad from Najjar.
Who is a Christian, but Ali Muhammad is a Christian, right? And wasn't still the argument from La Familia, or the request that he should change his name in order to make the radical right-wing fans happy?
Yeah.
So there still seems to be an issue going on to some degree, right?
It will always be an issue. Yeah. And when we move to speak about the deal, I will explain exactly how and what are the challenges coming really in the near future.
Because I think,
for example, Ali, think about the situation that, not in Corona days, but when Teddy Stadium is full and the whole crowd, when he passes an assist or in the player's presentation, the announcer says Ali and the whole stadium says Muhammad. You know, it's a statement by Beitar, and it's you know, for us maybe, oh come on, but he's half a Christian, and La Familia tried to ask him to change. Yeah, but in the end of the day, when there is a game of Beitar Jerusalem, we are talking about the most racist football club in Israel, maybe one of the most racist clubs in the world. This is a huge step forward in the right direction. Huge.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, you cannot win this war one day like this with a magic stick.
No, of course
it's a
not.
Process. And you need to change people's minds to reopen circles. So for this, you know, I'm trying to be myself very supportive, although, you know, someone who was born and raised in Jerusalem, and I grew on the other side of the road. I was a fan of Hapoel Jerusalem, a club with his own story, but completely the opposite from Beitar. It's something that I see very nice, and I think that they are going in the right direction. But yeah, I hope I answered the question. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, of course. I think what I took from the documentary was definitely not that it portrayed all Israeli football fans as right wing, but much rather that it shot a light or the focus on this one very radical part of Beitar Jerusalem, which was kind of driven forward by La Familia. And it kind of tried to deal with this specific problem and see how it was rooted within the society. But I think the interesting thing, or the interesting turning point in the documentary, is that first you see the Chechen players joining the team, and for a couple of minutes you think that maybe this might work out, because you have a press conference where everyone welcomes them, and you think, okay, maybe this is a happy ending, maybe this is going somewhere productive. But then there's this period where also the Boston bombing appears, and then one of the Chechen players actually scores a goal. And this is when La Familia, or at least the Western block, right? How are they called?
Which stand?
Yeah, stand? The Western stand,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The Western stand.
No, La Familia is in the Eastern stand.
The Eastern,
okay, sorry. I knew I'd get this wrong. The Eastern stand, sorry. The Eastern stand stands up, and they start to walk out of the stadium in a very, publicly, like, they demonstrated that they were fed up with this. And then what happens afterwards is that to all the next matches, barely any fans show up. And this is where you start to wonder as a viewer, okay, before you thought that La Familia was kind of this minor part of the fan base of Vital Jerusalem, but then how do they have this power to keep everyone else from coming? And I think that's where you start to think, okay, how much influence do they really have? What is the effect that they also have maybe beyond the stadium and within society? And I think that's one very interesting thing where it would be good for you to tell us, like, how does this work out?
Also, has it changed in the years since the documentary coming out in 2016?
Look, I think that it's a very good point you are touching here, because I think, and I've said, in a sad way a little bit, because I think all of the Israeli society has radicalized a lot in the past decade. And for me, it's hard because who I am, because my family, because the way I grew up, and it's hard to see. But many people said that football is the reflection of society. Yeah, but I say it's not a perfect reflection. It's like, it's not a mirror of society, but it gives you hints. Football gives you hints about something that is about to happen, or something that is taking place underground, and soon you will see it in the big stages. And this is exactly what happened here, because people really downplay the importance of this deal, which was historical and critical for Beitar at this point. A very radical act by Guy Damak and the club's management. But in the years to come, Israeli society became more radicalized in many aspects, whether there are Jews, Muslims, pro-Palestinians, anti-Palestinians. All this became really unbearable. You know, many people say, you know, it's a great country, great people, great food, everybody is so nice, doesn't matter. But there are so many groups, so many interests colliding, and the tension is high. And I think this story was a very big sign and hint on the direction that things are going. And you know, I'm talking about the microcosmos of Jerusalem and Israel, but it's a worldwide phenomenon. We see it, you know, a few days back in the Capitol Hill, in Washington, D.C., USA. You know, so for us, it was very hard because it was taking place in front of our eyes. And look, it was tough, but it hinted really the direction that Israeli society and Israeli politics went through, because La Familia and many similar sister movements became more present in Jerusalem, in the streets. I don't know if these names will tell you something, but the Kahana Tzadak, Leava, it's these kinds of movements that, you know, are very much extreme right-wing, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, anti-any integration between populations, very, you know, this jealousy for Judaism and stuff like this that are not representing in any way the majority of Israeli society, which is you know, built from so many people from so many backgrounds and religions and beliefs and lifestyles that, you know, it's sad. But in many cases, especially in football, we let the extremists define us, especially when we tell our stories outside. So, you know, the challenge for people like me was to show that, yeah, you can, you know, you can be at the first step for our Indian followers, to show them, yeah, I can be from Israel and from Jerusalem and into football, but not racist at all, and it doesn't say anything about me. But on the wider aspect, I think that Beitar and Israeli football and many people had to clean their image that was created by this movie. Not created, but got a really serious push for its, I would say, stereotype. And we are still doing it. Look, for example, you know, it's also a sad thing because 2 years ago, the Israeli national team had a record of 7 non-Jewish players in the starting lineup. 6, sorry, in the starting lineup. And 7 in the squad. Someone wrote about it. It opened the story in the New York Times, BBC. Nah, it's less interesting. It's more sexy when you have a violent bunch of men like La Familia that going around screaming and doing, you know, bad reputation to Israel and Jerusalem and Beitar. So I get it, and this is the game. But there are many things here, so it's complex. And I don't remember what was the original question. Again, I hope I answered it. Yeah.
No, I think you answered it. Maybe, and beyond. Cool. So I think let's fast forward to 2020. Now that we sort of laid the groundwork. So, yeah. In last year, a disembowelled member of the Abu Dhabi royal family in the UAE has bought Bin Khalifa bought a 50% stake in Beitar Jerusalem, and mm-hmm. So this was the story which sort of grabbed my attention and also people around the world. So what has been the reaction in both in Israel and also in the region to this deal, as also it falls, I guess, as part of the Israeli UAE sort of normalization agreement and growing normalization of ties between the countries? What has been the reaction to it, both in football and also generally in Israel?
Yeah, so we are talking about, you know, every year in Baba Gol we are doing the best of the year. From 2016 until today, 2020, each year we pick the 20 biggest stories in football. Good, bad, sad, happy, whatever we choose. For me, this story is basically the football business story of not 2020, of the decade, or maybe the past generation. Because everything we spoke about now, it's something that really impacts the life of millions. Beitar's identity in Israel, the right-wing identity in Israel, the Chechen players, the racism, La Familia, Arkady Gaidmak, all this is sitting here. And for us, the first time we heard the thing about, you know, a Muslim Arab man from the Abu Dhabi royal family who want to invest, I'm not talking about buying part of the club, want to invest in Beitar Jerusalem, it's something, you know, you take the brain out of the head and you hang it in the air. It's impossible, yeah? So for me, and I, you know, I got this support for this thesis of mine, from one really great person and writer and journalist and author, James Montagu, which is a fundamental read for everyone, I think, who loves football. Each one of his books, whether When Friday Comes.
Oh, yeah, I'm currently reading his book on ultras, the one, yeah.
Yeah, and the ultras, right, the new one, 1312.
Yeah.
So James agreed with me and said, this is unbelievable. Like, this story is the biggest story. But you are lucky to speak with me, and I tell you why. I was the only journalist, Israeli specifically, but also in general, the only journalist who was there in Dubai during the signing of the agreement.
Okay.
And I must tell you, with the introduction that we spoke about now, where I come from, Jerusalem, I'm a Middle Eastern football journalist in the past 7 years. Basically, it was a meeting. It was the perfect junction. We talked about junction in the beginning of the conversation. It was the perfect junction. I felt like I'm going to Dubai. I was there a couple of times before, Asian Cup, AFC Champions League, all kind of cool games. But this was an hallucination that taking place for me. You know, my niche, my professional niche, and my city, and my football, Israeli football, are meeting in this impossible football deal. And I was super excited. I closed many gigs with multiple media bodies from around the world. Ghana, Nigeria, Israel, of course, the New York Times, England, the UAE also, Qatar. It was crazy, okay? Now, I landed there, and I was like a kid showing up for a party. I said, this is a big moment, yeah? But apparently, in the United Arab Emirates, no journalist that I spoke with knew about this deal.
But how did you know about it?
I knew about it. But there, nobody heard about this guy, the Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa. Yeah. Nobody. I said, okay, it's weird, but maybe football is not interesting for people here, or Beitar is not a big name enough. But you know, it was very weird because we had this historical peace agreement, Abraham Accords, Israel, the UAE, Bahrain, all coming together. There is a serious wind of change here in the region now, yes, because many of financial agreements are taking place. There is a huge sense of you know, convergence here, right, in these days, in this way. And it was weird because I covered the story of Dia Saba. Dia Saba, first Israeli player to play in Arab League, signed for Nasser Dubai in the end of September, basically. And you know, there was a huge excitement about it in the UAE. But, man, nobody knew about the Beitar Jerusalem story. And I said, come on, man. Every Arab knows what Beitar Jerusalem is. Every Danish kid who just Google football racism find out about the Beitar Jerusalem. There is no way nobody knows about it. And I start digging and digging and digging, but I needed to report. And at that moment, the first day I was there, It was still this story, this historical, mind-blowing, barrier-breaking football business incident that I happened to be the only journalist to cover. So I reported the New York Times and I reported multiple medias about it, and it was a celebration. But something felt missing for me because there was no echo around. No one from the journalist, and I talked with around 20, knew about this or was invited to the press conference the day after. The press conference included only Israeli journalists by Zoom, BBC, New York Times, Washington Post, and that's it. Now, you sit there, and I'm sitting and I'm saying, there is no way. How is this possible? What is going on? So I start asking more and more people about this guy. And basically, it will be a big, very big piece about it in Babagol, which I'm working on it in the past month, basically. Because this story hasn't ended yet.
Okay.
They did the presentation with the shirt and everything. They enjoyed the PR that's coming with it. As I said and just mentioned, you mentioned also, Liam, all the Western media was all over this story. But in the Arab world, the only media bodies to report it were Qatari, Egyptian, Arabic-speaking Turkish medias, all the medias that are against the group of countries, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, who are normalizing with Israel. Because they use the story to say, look, these traitors, the UAE, are now owning 50% of the most racist club in Israel, a club that its fans are singing against the Prophet, against Muhammad. And I found it really interesting, and I started speaking with many people, and this deal is far from over, because someone here is playing a very interesting game, playing a very interesting game with the emotions of the fans, first of all.
What were the reactions of the fans, like, when this came out, when you made the story public? What were the responses?
Wow, look, this story is currently circulating already. Basically, we've seen something very interesting among Beitar fans, okay? First of all, for the first time, there was a majority in the crowd who supported this kind of move. Mm-hmm. They came, protested, they had signs, huge signs and banners in support of Hamed Ben Khalifa. And La Familia, who came to the first practice after the deal, protested. There were only 70 people. When you saw the movie Forever Pure, there were 10,000 a game, 5,000 in each practice, protesting. So I think the only real thing, really, something real that taking place from this deal is the momentum that the unpopular voice in Beitar Jerusalem fans, the voice that calls for coexistence, the voice that says, let's put racism aside, let's forget about this, let's move on. We want to be a successful football club. We want to have Arab players. We want to have an Arab owner. This voice grew and became much more stronger than what it was, no doubt about it. But the whole commercial side of this deal and administrative side of this deal is far from over, because there is, I don't want to say, and I don't want to spoil, you know, I'm doing a huge teaser here for this piece.
Yeah, that's fine.
Keep the powder dry.
Yeah, but this deal is fishy. This deal is fishy as hell. And someone is taking advantage of the momentum with the peace agreement, with all the peace environment, and also taking advantage of the name Beitar Jerusalem and the fact that we live in Arab owner, in order to shade on a much broader and grayer deal that's taking place in the background. And right now it's only circulating in Israeli media, but so be sure that it's going to be one of the most complicated pieces that will be embobbable.
So
because
the actual
story is really open up my mind to, first of all, football business is a sewer. Yeah, it's something very dirty. There is no romanticism or a sense of you know, representation of a new Beitar Jerusalem, not at all. Unfortunately, this is what I discovered in Dubai, and moreover, in the past months since, basically, I'm finding myself doing journalism of, you know, crime journalism, not football journalism, or something like this. Yeah.
But isn't that exactly what you talked about at the beginning of this pod? That it is this intersectionality that's very interesting in football and in the stories that you cover. So what I've gotten out of this so far is that it might just be a distraction act to cover up something bigger that is happening behind the scenes. And the very interested reader of Baba Go will find out more in future times and in the weeks to come.
I don't want to publish a half-ass piece. I want the whole picture, you know.
No, of course. Because, I mean, also, I read some of the German news coverage about this, and then a piece we read in the New York Times. And there it was portrayed as, of course, a great opportunity to rewrite history a bit for the club. and to see that there's actually more harmonization going on there. And so, of course, having seen the documentary first, you could think that, okay, maybe now it is moving in the right direction. Maybe some progressive and positive energy is going on there. But of course, what you are saying now makes it all the more interesting, and you start to question this and see what the actual motivations are behind all of this.
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest lesson for me, and I think it's a very important lesson for any aspiring journalist, things are never black and white. And especially when you are dealing with such extreme elements in societies and history, things will never be perfect.
Yeah.
It can still be a barrier-breaking incident that will change the history of this club, but on the same time, a mega fraud involving Bitcoin, politics, and crimes from all over the world. It can be.
Yeah.
So, and for me, you know, it's a story that I'm privileged to cover, but it's also a story that I had few times that I discussed with myself, do I have the tools to cover it properly? You know, you need to be an intelligence agent.
Yeah.
Basically. you are right. You said something nice. You know, it really is where we started the conversation, that the football and Babagol is in the intersection of football and wider topics. But this monster has 8 heads. Yeah, it's crazy.
Spirally, so one of the heads is
basically the impact on the crowd, really, and the shifts and the changes that the crowd is going through in this team. And there are risks, because right now, basically, I will tell you where we are standing. We are waiting for the decision of the committee for approval of commercial rights. Okay?
Yeah.
It's a body within the Israeli Football Association that needs basically to approve the new owner of 50% of Beitar Jerusalem. Again, if it wasn't clear by now, one of the biggest institutions of Israeli sport, maybe the biggest symbol for Zionism and right wing in Israel.
Yeah.
And so it's you know, you have all the focus and all the media on this committee. And they invited the investigation from a private business intelligence company, and their report was very bad. On the tip of the iceberg, I will tell you, the chef wasn't called Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa until not so long ago. Basically, this thing I already discovered in Dubai, but they discovered, like, it's a rabbit hole, basically, of small crimes and crypto, and Alice in the Wonderland is a kid's story.
There's nothing. Wow.
This is
a cliffhanger.
So we are waiting to see the decision, basically.
Yeah.
And we will know where it goes, because there might be a chance, a slight chance, that they won't approve it, and there will be no deal. And it will be more interesting if we try to think on the impact on the crowd.
Yeah.
If the deals fall through, La Familia will say, you see, we told you. Mm-hmm. Beitar shouldn't have an Arab owner. And then all this positive momentum we witnessed will change. Otherwise, maybe people will say, no, we already made a step forward. We're going to fight La Familia. But if we want to fight La Familia for real and to beat them once and for all and clean Beitar Jerusalem, you need a lot more than $100 million.
Yeah.
You need like $1 billion at least.
Yeah, and that's what I was wondering about in general, because it was portrayed as this huge chance, as I said earlier. But also, how effective are these kind of top-down decision-making processes, right? So you suddenly have someone with enormous finances buying half of the shares of the club, and then that's portrayed as this move in the right direction. But doesn't it need to be built from the bottom up? Isn't it also with the fans, with the culture, with the acceptance towards people from other countries? These things are not changed by one transfer or by the change of one chairperson or the one owner of the club, right? This is something bigger and broader that has needs probably community work and a bigger movement. And so with all of these stories, what I was missing a bit was, how did the fans react to this? What does this mean in general in the social change of the fan culture for Beitar Jerusalem, and maybe also within the bigger picture of Israel in general? Because I think that's at the end the important thing that needs to change or to evolve. And I think, yeah, what this should be all about.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, someone who sees the exactly like you, the community of the game is very important. So I'm saying it's complex because it's still, the change is still going on.
Yeah.
The fight is live and kicking right now while we speak, and we still don't have the full picture. We still don't know the end of the story for sure. And count on me. If it's Beitar Jerusalem, it will be. It's a jungle. It's a circus without a roof. It will get even madder next week when they want a program, for example. Okay, and then the owner Moshe Chogeg will say, "Okay, so we'll go from behind. He will be a sponsor, and I will be the full owner. But he will have the face, and we will decide this. It will be crazy. And if they will approve him." Man, the reaction of La Familia, it haven't started yet. Wait, if it will be approved, okay, and our players will start to come, then the real deal will start. We will see if they are up for the real fight, because there it will be blood and it will be bad.
Sounds like a job guarantee.
Sure. What?
Sounds like a job guarantee.
For you.
Much more things to uncover.
I'm conscious of the time, so I just want to quickly touch on the second topic that I wanted to bring you on to discuss, was because we're a year away from the World Cup in Qatar, the first World Cup in the region, and, you know, obviously we shouldn't ignore a lot of the issues that are sort of especially brought up whenever we discuss the World Cup in Western media around construction rights and the death toll of the construction workers who are, you know, dying building these stadiums. But I was curious about what you foresee as sort of being the impact of the World Cup being hosted in this region. Do you see it sort of fitting in into this trying mood of sort of peace and normalization among relations, or do you see it sort of not really having much of a... Or what about its impact on football, even in the region?
Yeah, I was glad to see this question in the lineup you sent me, Alex. And because I think that the World Cup in Qatar, in a way, became a taboo that you cannot express a complicated thought about it. And when I mean a complicated thought, I mean exactly like what we did now. We spoke about Beitar Jerusalem, racism, football, Arab ownership on the club, and we said, it might be good, but it also might be bad in the same time. And this is a complicated fault. And I think that the story about Qatar World Cup, which has many, many dark sides, of course, it's a very complicated fault, and it needs to be discussed in a more gentle way and more eye-opening way to understand what we are talking about. We are talking about maybe the only chance of the Middle East in the past 100 years or more to show to the world that this region is a fantastic place to play football, to meet people, to enjoy good food, to get a personal introduction to amazing cultures with superb hospitality capabilities, everything, really. It's a unique chance for a whole region, but because it's Qatar, and because it's the Middle East, and because many bad things took place in the preparation, okay, and that we are talking about a country and a society and a region that has been transformed and changed so much from the moment that Qatar got the won the bid to host until now, talking about 12 years by now, that to only focus on the death of workers, which is horrific and shocking and an unjustified situation, there is no argument about it. And on the same time, we are not seeing the wider topic, the wider picture. And when I'm saying the wider picture, is basically the World Cup changed places. I've been to the World Cup in Russia to cover. It was a World Cup with a record number of 5 Middle Eastern national teams. I was there. I had plenty of work in the group stage. After the group stage, I lost all my work. But few editors like my point of view, so you know they told me write about Russia, write about Croatia, go enjoy yourself and give us your thoughts. But I saw how the World Cup is changing Russia, and for me, as the first World Cup I'm attending, it was very important to be there ahead, many times ahead. I came 2 weeks, almost 3 weeks before the tournament. I want to see Moscow and Russia changing. I wanted to see the first moment of change, because this place, for the first time, opened its gates to 4.5 million people to come and visit in 1 month. Russia never had this amount of people coming to visit as tourists. And I think the Middle East is in the same situation. We are suffering from stereotypes. Israel is suffering from stereotypes. Qataris, Saudis, Arab Muslims as a whole, Arab Christians, Lebanese people, Egyptians, North Africans, Berber, everyone. We are the others. We are the pineapple that, yeah, once in a few seasons we have a very good player that shine in the Premier League or in the Bundesliga. And then you hear about us, the places that these players are coming from. And I think the World Cup in Qatar, first of all, without taking downgrade any importance of the horrific situation that took place in the construction sites there, Qatar never hosted the World Cup. It's a world that lives in a different way than the rest of the world, than Western Europe, than the US, okay? They worked in this way for hundreds of years. The World Cup put a situation, a fact on surface, and basically made this place to change their construction law. Right now, they are working by the EU construction law because of the World Cup, because of everything. So I'm saying it's bad, but on the same time, maybe this was the price. This was the horrific price that we need to charge in order to change something, in order to create a new reality. And about the bribery allegations, for example, yeah, it's okay. It's easy to focus about Qatar and the World Cup, but also Russia there was bribery involved. And we also know that in Germany 2006,
yeah. I mean, the bribery thing is I think it's very much on my list of sort of maybe apprehensions about the Qatar World Cup. It's quite low, because we know, I mean, what we know now is that, you know, all the countries were doing it. It's just England were worse at it than other places, and, you know, they weren't escaped. So
we discovered very interesting thing. Okay, also in Brazil, they moved thousands of people out of their homes to build fan zones. In South Africa, you will never know how many workers died building the soccer city. what we now know, and very good, we know it, that you know, having mega international events on countries that has not, that doesn't have the infrastructure to host it, you need to build it. And if you build it, and you build it by the laws and measurement of these countries before any reform, you're going to see something you don't like, something that wouldn't take place in Germany or France, maybe. All right, but this country needs to have its chance to change. You know, don't judge it like this. They're trying very hard. And I'm saying again, the World Cup in Qatar is a huge chance for the whole region to show a different face. Not only to Qatar. It's a unique chance for us Middle Easterners to show our touch for football the way we see it. And I believe it will be a great World Cup. It will, if there will be fans, of course, you know. And for me, I think it's a huge possibility and a huge chance for the whole world. Because in this manner, you know, which Qatar was involved in the blockade with Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia also pushed for the media about Qatar, and they really tried to grab this World Cup and move it, make it an all Middle Eastern tournament, or even take it and host it themselves. There was like a small venture they tried to do a couple of years ago. It became very political, of course, within the Middle East also. I'm saying, you know, if we take this view of judging Qatar now about these things, you know, we can judge. Why should Germany host football sports events? In the Olympics of 1972, there was Jewish athletes that were murdered. They shouldn't host. Let's not talk about history and what took place in 1939 to 1944 in Germany. Come on. These people need to host? No. So we are not talking about this because the time has passed and we are mature people and we know that places and people change. Or even if they are not changing their heart, they are doing an effort to change their habits, give them a chance. Maybe they will be better in a few years. Maybe this kind of event can change the whole region, have a tremendous impact on peace. And real peace, not the Abraham Accords out of the blue, yalla, Israel and the UAE. Talking about people, man. You know, to hug, to eat hummus together. This is what I'm talking about. And I really hope this will be the impact of the World Cup 22 in Qatar. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for this. Because yeah, I do think that there's definitely this bigger story to be told, and I felt like this was very much it. So thank you.
So I feel like we've thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
For sure.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Before we finish up, is there anything you'd like to plug, or what's going on in 2021 for Baba Goal? You sort of hinted at with this story, but expanding on that, what else is going on?
Yeah, so it's a good chance to say that we made some few, you know, tweaks, and we fixed few bugs we had in the website not too long ago, and we are really building on 2021 and 2022. To be significant years for this project. First for Middle Eastern football, but many more cool stories from all over, you know, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. A new podcast is coming out soon, I believe February or March. And we will do it, of course, in the Baba Goal style. So don't expect anything normal. It's going to be funny. Of course, the Beitar story that we will keep following, and you know, Israeli football, Palestinian football, Arab football, and North African football as a whole, our scouting edition. And we are about to put an effort about more long form pieces, more proper journalism. We try to do it once a week. We'll see what our capacity, maybe once a month, but I want to give the reader something that they won't read anywhere else, not only by the story, but also by the quality. So it will require more for the team, but I think we can do it. For sure, we will try. You know?
It sounds great. It sounds great. And I encourage all our listeners to check out Baba Goal online and follow you on social media. You're on Twitter. I think it's Liv.
For sure.
Liv, what's your Twitter handle?
Twitter is Baba Goal and like I don't know how you say like this
capital letters.
The underline thing.
Ah,
the underline. Yeah. Baba Goal underline on Twitter, on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. Soon, I hope Spotify and the rest of the places you can listen to podcasts to. Yeah. At babagoal.net or babagoal.com. Actually, it's a funny thing, you know. We bought babagoal.com URL. It was a domain. Basically, it was a deal that I worked on 7 years. I tried to buy babagoal.com from 2014, and every year we were negotiating. They wanted $21,000 for this, but thanks to coronavirus, I managed to get a better deal. So yeah, also babagoal.com. You can click and you find everything you need in the website.
All right, that sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, Yuri. I feel like we could have talked about these topics for hours.
For sure, always. It was a huge pleasure, guys. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for the insights. That was really, really interesting. Wow.
Network.